It is Wednesday, January 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Senate Democrats accuse President Donald Trump of failing to confront the Russian threat.
This is about what Russia has done over a 20-year period, targeting all of its neighbors and really most of Europe.
South Korea's president indicates he would be willing to hold talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and we hear the single from the soundtrack of the new film, 50 Shades Freed. It's all ahead. U.S. Senate Democrats on Wednesday warned that Russian operations to undermine democracy extend far beyond U.S. elections and accused President Donald Trump of failing to confront the threat. Senator Ben Cardin released a report prepared by the committee's Democratic staff members that accused Russia of mounting a protracted assault on democracy at home and abroad and urged a multi-pronged counter-strategy that begins with U.S. presidential leadership. Based on months of research and consultations with foreign governments targeted by the Kremlin, the 206-page report exhaustively documented the full array of tools Russia has wielded beyond its borders. I spoke with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman about the Republican response to the report.
Sarah, this was released by Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They are in the minority, and there was no Republican participation in this report. However, Republicans have acknowledged that the report exists. They are not contesting, at least publicly, not immediately contesting the findings of this report, but they are noting that, in fact, Congress has taken action against Russia and that members of Congress of both parties have not been silent on the question of Russian meddling in the United States and in other countries.
What does the report say about efforts by Russian President Vladimir Putin to, what it says, undermine democracy, not only in the U.S., but also in Europe?
Well, Democratic staffers who wrote the report, and I was able to meet with them, and they provided Voice of America with an advanced copy of this report on Tuesday. They stressed that this is not in any sense a report about what happened in the United States in the 2016 election. This is not about what Russia did in 2016 in the United States. This is about what Russia has done over a 20-year period, targeting all of its neighbors and really most of Europe, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and this pattern and the arsenal of tools that Russia has deployed in trying to subvert the democratic process. And the argument that Senate Democrats are making is that unless you understand and comprehend the full scope of what Russia has been up to, not just in the United States but elsewhere, then it's really impossible to formulate a strategy to combat that threat.
What are some of the tools that Democrats say the Russians have used?
It depends on the country. The report says that Vladimir Putin has a, quote, asymmetrical arsenal that ranges from, quote, a lethal blend of conventional military assaults, assassinations, disinformation campaigns, and cyber attacks in Ukraine, plotting a coup in Montenegro, and disinformation and cyber attacks in Germany, France, the United Kingdom, and far beyond. If you read this report, and I do have to say that I did, it was a 206-page report, it goes into exhaustive and excruciating detail about the various tactics that have been deployed against a whole host of countries. And this report is now publicly available. It can be read online.
Well, it's interesting you say that this has really been compiled from the last two decades, because that was way before the advent of social media, which, you know, observers have cited a lot in more recent reports on possible Russian activity in regard to elections.
Indeed. And obviously what has gained the most attention in the United States in regard to the 2016 election was the disinformation campaign and the use of false Twitter accounts and false Facebook accounts and all the various things that have been tied to shadowy groups in Moscow that are believed to be tied to the Kremlin. obviously, a decade ago, 2 decades ago, neither Facebook nor Twitter existed. But the report very carefully details that even before the advent of social media, that there were very robust influence campaigns that were being waged. Well, Sarah, I will just say that this report comes in the context of a whole host of Russia investigations that are going on Capitol Hill. And these investigations have spawned a great deal of partisan friction of late. The goal of the Senate Democratic Minority Report out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was not to further inflame those partisan tensions, at least according to the staffers. It was really to speak about Russian tactics and Russian strategies. And they believe that many of the findings of the report could be accepted on a bipartisan basis. But we do have to acknowledge that just a few hours ago, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein on the Senate Judiciary Committee released a very sensitive transcript relating to the Russia investigation and a dossier of information that the United States acquired. And so there are all kinds of tensions that are going on, and I don't think that we can ignore the backdrop of what is truly an extensive Russia investigation on Capitol Hill involving multiple committees in both houses of Congress.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, I will say that just stemming off that last report, for those who are interested, there are really two reports that have come out. One, a transcript of the interview that the Senate Intelligence Committee had with one of the Fusion GPS principals. That's about 317 pages. And the report that Michael Bowman was just talking about, it's about a little over 200 pages. They're both very much floating around out there on social media. You can find the links. So if anybody's wanting to pursue those, you know, really in depth, you have the resources. You can read them on your phone or, you know, wherever you might be. Just, you know, I would say search around on social media, say Twitter or Facebook, for example, and, you know, look for Senate Intel Report or the Russia Intel Report. Those are both trending, and many, many people are posting and reposting them. But instead, I thought today maybe just a little bit of food for thought. So Warren Buffett, the billionaire investor, he was once famed for, somebody said, what's the secret to your tremendous success? And he was in his office, and he turned around and he pointed at the bookshelf, and he said, quote, read 500 pages like this every day. That's how knowledge works. It builds up like compound interest. All of you can do it, but I guarantee not many of you will. Hmm. Now, 500 pages a day.
Yeah, that's like a lot.
That sounds like a lot. But I thought we'd break the numbers down a little bit. Now, for example, if you were to, I won't ask you to guess, but the average American, pardon me, the average American spends about 600 or over hours a year on social media alone, and over 1,600 hours watching television. So combined, that's a good 2,200 plus hours a year. And if you kind of do the math a little bit, say, let's say maybe you wanted to read, you know, 100, 200 books a year, that seems like a phenomenal amount. But if you kind of break down, well, how long is the average book, how many words, what's the average American reading speed and whatnot, it comes to maybe about 400 hours or so a year. And put in that context, if you think, you know, we spend how many countless hours just sort of randomly flipping around on Twitter or Facebook or whatnot, really just not seeing anything, that is time that certainly could be used for sitting down, picking up a book, and plowing through a couple hundred pages. So I just thought I'd bring a little perspective. We talk a lot about social media, and it is important, but it's not the only thing, and there's still, I think, something to be said for a good old-fashioned book.
Well, and also when you think of how busy people are,
you know,
having jobs, doing chores, mm-hmm. childcare, elder care, pet care, all of those things, you know,
yeah.
that's...
But and then again, there are so many different ways to consume a book. You can listen to it, you know, on your headphones.
That's
in a
true.
Car. You can, you know, read it on your phone or on a tablet or, you know, bits and pieces here. So there's it really is, I think, kind of perspective and choices, you know, the choices of how we're spending and allotting our time.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands clashes with Dutch reporters over controversial remarks he made about Muslims. Myanmar formally charges two Reuters journalists. The White House says it is outrageous that a U.S. court has blocked President Trump's decision to end the protection of young immigrants. And Vice President Mike Pence will lead the U.S. delegation to the Winter Olympics. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A number of studies have linked sedentary or inactive lifestyles to higher risks of a number of chronic illnesses and a shortened lifespan. Research has also shown that inactivity can lead to a stiffening of the muscle in the heart's left ventricle, which pumps oxygenated blood through the aorta to the rest of the body. A new study by cardiologists at the University of Texas Southwestern and Texas Health Resources have found that exercise could actually reverse this heart damage and help prevent future heart failure. But to reap the heart health benefits, the cardiologists recommend a 4 or 5 times a week exercise regimen that includes high-intensity aerobics, preferably before age 65. The study's senior author, Dr. Benjamin Levine from UT Southwestern, says this dose of exercise has become his prescription for life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, music from the new film, 50 Shades Freed. A day after North and South Korea met in their first high-level talks in more than 2 years, South Korean President Moon Jae-in says he's open to a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
남북 관계 개선과 북핵 문제 해결에 필요하다면
Facing reporters Wednesday, Mr. Moon said he's open to any form of meeting under the right conditions, but not just talks for the sake of talks. He also gave credit to President Donald Trump for helping to bring about the conditions that permitted the talks in the truce village of Panmunjom to occur. The meeting resulted in the North's announcement it will participate in next month's Winter Olympic Games in South Korea and reestablish a military hotline with Seoul. The two sides may also meet for military talks to avoid any miscalculations. The U.S. said Tuesday's talks were a positive development, but the State Department insisted that the North's participation in the Games does not violate U.N. Security Council sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a White House spokeswoman.
Certainly the next steps would be denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is our number one priority and certainly what we would like to see. We are in very close contacts with our South Korean allies about these conversations. The president spoke with Moon over the weekend. I don't believe they've spoken since then, but I know officials from our administration have been in touch with officials from the South Korean side.
Troy Stangarone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the thaw in Korean relations is a positive development, but he urged caution.
Right now, there's still some technical details to be worked out, so things could change potentially depending on how the North Koreans respond to whatever restrictions may be placed on them or any requests they make that South Korea is unwilling to fulfill. So we should be cautiously optimistic, I think, at this point. But we also need to consider that many people are trying to perhaps put more weight on these talks than we should. This is about trying to take and change the dynamic It's about hoping to take and have a successful Olympics. Anything that goes beyond that, I think we should be more cautious about right now.
The South Koreans indicated that they hope this is the beginning of a long process that will ultimately lead to a lessening of nuclear tensions. Is that possible?
It'll depend on North Korea's behavior. Right now, there's been no explicit statement of what North Korea's participation entails in terms of North Korea refraining from conducting tests during this period. While one could argue that there is a tacit understanding of that, because should they conduct a test before the Olympics or during the Olympics, that would clearly undermine the spirit of this agreement and also undermine confidence in dealing with North Korea. The real test will become right after the Olympics. Exercises were delayed to the beginning of April. There's a very good chance North Korea may choose that as an opportunity to take and conduct another test. If they do refrain, though, then that might create more space, but we'll really have to see.
Grant Newsham, a senior research fellow at the Tokyo-based Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, also urged caution about North Korea's intentions, insisting its goal is reunification of the two Koreas on North Korea's terms.
That said, it's always a good thing, I think, especially when the militaries talk to each other or have some sort of communication. I would suggest that the militaries talking to each other is even preferable than the sort of the diplomats and even the politicians talking to each other.
The chief of the North Korean delegation, Ri Song-gwan, said something remarkable. He said all our weapons, including atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, and ballistic missiles, are only aimed at the U.S., not at South Korea, China, or Russia. Was that a surprising announcement?
Not really. You'll notice he appears not to have mentioned Japan. It's intended to sort of sow doubt, ideally split relationships. It has a very definite meaning, and the idea is to continue to sow doubt in that part of the South Korean population that does think a deal can be reached with North Korea if they just talk about it, and somehow that the two countries can get back together and bring the Korean people back together. If allowed to fester or continue to its logical extent, you just might find that the South Korean apologists, the sympathizers, putting it uncharitably, the useful idiots, just might be able to, over time, create some distance between South Korea and the United States, which ultimately is North Korea's objective, in my opinion.
At his Wednesday news conference, President Moon said Tuesday's talks were only the beginning, a first step and a good start. Bringing North Korea to denuclearization talks, he added, is the next step we must take. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. Two pop stars participate in a single from the soundtrack of a new film. I'm joined by VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London, who has all the details.
Today we're talking movie music from the soundtrack of a film that's coming out February 9th, the third installment into the 50 Shades series of films. This one's called 50 Shades Freed, and the soundtrack comes out on Friday, January 12th. This week, Liam Payne and Rita Ora released a 20-second snippet of a song they've put on the soundtrack, kind of a tease of a song that's expected to do very well for Liam Payne and Rita Ora together. The soundtrack in its entirety to the film includes music from Sia, Ellie Goulding, Hailee Steinfeld, Blood Pop, and many others. But today, we're going to check out the first single to be released from the soundtrack, and this one is called For You, Liam Payne and Rita Ora.
Skin to skin, breathe me in, fill with your kiss.
Well, I know, Larry, we've talked just recently about Liam Payne.
Yes.
I don't know about Rita Ora.
Well, Liam put out, he hasn't put out his album yet, but he put out, you know, On the Bedroom Floor, which we played on the International Edition segment not too long ago. But now Liam has followed in the footsteps of another former member of One Direction. Last year, it was Zayn and Taylor Swift who released I Don't Want to Live Forever from 50 Shades Darker. So now it's Liam Payne and Rita Ora. And for you, Rita Ora is from Kosovo originally. She's lived in London for a number of years. She acted in several films. She has put out music. In fact, I believe her third album is due out this year. Tremendously talented young lady who's had quite, you know, a successful run so far in showbiz. And originally the song was supposed to feature Justin Bieber, but Justin wasn't available, so they recruited Liam Payne to sing the song with Rita Ora, and I love it. It's a great sounding song, and it's called For You. And Rita has plans. You know, she's recorded duets with Iggy Azalea and several other folks, but she has some big plans in the music business, and hopefully they'll all come to fruition for her.
Well, that seems often a number of pop stars, if they can, they do record for the movies. Certainly many James Bond films, we've had a variety of singers over the years.
Yes, yeah, Sam Smith recorded an Oscar-winning song from a couple of years ago, and there's a report that the Bond family, the Bond organization, is in touch with Sam about recording another song for a future James Bond film. But yeah, it's very common that the pop stars going back, you know, I'm Shirley Bassey, Goldfinger, and Carly Simon, you know, she sang Diamonds Are Forever and several other songs. So there's been a number of big songs from big singers in the pop world over the years. Adele, of course, had a James Bond film song out a few years back as well. So yeah, that's a common occurrence, and it's a great way to get noticed if you need that kind of attention.
All right, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. Been waiting for a lifetime for you. Been praying for a lifetime. And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Journalism remains a dangerous profession in too many places around the world. On October 16th, Daphne Caruana Galizia, a journalist reporting on corruption in Malta as part of the Panama Papers investigation, was killed by a car bomb. In September, attackers set fire to the car of Yulia Latinina, a columnist for Novaya Gazeta and host of a weekly radio show in Russia. Protecting journalists and media practitioners against violence from those who may want to censor them is a core tenet of freedom of expression, said Shannon McGuire, a media advisor with USAID's Bureau for Europe and Eurasia, promoting independent media development. Since 1992, more than 800 journalists have been murdered around the world, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ. Of those cases, 86% were killed with impunity, meaning no one has been held responsible. In Russia, which ranks in the top 10 of CPJ's list, the attack on Latinina was just the latest in a series of assaults and threats against Russian journalists and opposition figures that have not resulted in formal charges. In Ukraine, the murder of prominent investigative journalist Pavel Sheremet also remains unsolved more than a year later. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has prioritized support to independent media in Europe and Eurasia since beginning work there in 1992. Its programs focus both on the supply and demand sides of news and information, as well as advocating for greater press freedom. One such program is the Regional Investigative Journalism Network, which helps shield reporters from attack by making it more difficult for criminals to pinpoint those who have exposed their wrongdoings. In Ukraine, USAID's U Media Project has collaborated with more than 500 independent media outlets to ensure that professional journalists operate safely and protect their data in conflict areas in eastern Ukraine and Crimea while they report on the fighting and Russian occupation. Donors, policymakers, advocacy organizations, and civil society organizations must continue to exert pressure on those involved in censorship to ensure the continuation of open, public debate and the free flow of information. Journalists are not soldiers, and their cameras and pens are not weapons, said Ms. McGuire. They shouldn't need to fear the phrase, "Don't kill the messenger."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.